session number 25448, Reel 12. General Menezes, Reel 12. Now we were talking about your time with the headquarters, and your next move was in July 1964 for a year at the infantry school at Mao. Now, what exactly there? You were to be the commander of the tactical wing. Could you describe what was the background to your posting there?
I was posted as the commander of the tactical wing to command courses that were run at platoon and company commander level. And of course, Mao is spelt by the British, M-H-A-W. Normally it was, the village in Hindi would have been M-A-U, but that was, as Hobson Jobson would say, the British pronunciation. They spelt it according to their pronunciation. But other people have sort of punned on it and said MHOW stands for the Military Headquarters of War. So, to some extent, you can say it is the Military Headquarters of War, because the tactical thinking of the Indian Army is concentrated at this place, Mao. So, what was the infantry school has now become the College of Combat.
Now, tell me about your role. What exactly were you doing as commander of the tactical wing?
As the commander of the tactical wing, as I said, we had to train platoon commanders and company commanders in tactics. It had become more important as a result of our recent operations with the Chinese. So therefore, it was decided that we would also introduce what would be called outdoor exercises. Otherwise, these people had been trained entirely with sand model discussions or tactical exercises with our troops outdoors. But now we introduced a feature apart from the sand model discussions and the tactical exercises with our troops. We also introduced outdoor exercises inasmuch as these people would be formed up into companies, the people attending the course. So if 120 people were doing the junior commander's course, the equivalent of the company commander's course, they would actually be made into a rifle company with all the weapons that they would get. And in terms of our experience, we had not to be road bound anymore. So we now provided them mules. So all these exercises were outdoors, cross-country, and therefore got these people thinking more, instead of being road-bound, being more maneuverable by being able to attack the enemy from the rear, and if you were ambushed or cut off, you will not be dependent on the road itself for maintenance. It was an interesting experience, and we were able to reorientate the platoon commander's courses and this company commander or junior commander's course to make it more realistic in terms of our terrain problems. Because as I said earlier, no other army in the world has been involved to the extent that we have with counterinsurgency for so many years, as well as the variety in terrain. Today you may be in the jungle, tomorrow you'll be in the desert. And so therefore we've got to survive despite, we're all creatures of our climate basically, so we can't undo the terrain.
Anything else about your time there? Was there any new level of tactics? I mean, had things changed at all since your time?
No, as I said, in problems like defense or attack or advance or withdrawal, the tactics are not new. It is how it is the terrain in which you have to implement them. So therefore, so far, it had been entirely in terms of a road access. Now, of course, we got them thinking to be able to do everything cross-country and in a variety of terrain. There are forests around about Mao, there's open terrain around about Mao. So we got them to get into the forests also, or jungles, to use the local term. And as I've said, we progressed from calling it the infantry school to the College of Combat. The infantry school is now entirely a weapons school, and that is at a place called Belgaum.
Now, you were there for about a year, till September 65.
Yes. Then the 1965 operations took place. Pakistan and China were in collusion. Pakistan attacked and prevailed upon the Chinese, or the Chinese agreed to, that they would put pressure on the border with us so that we could not divert troops against the Pakistanis, the Chinese pinning them down.
Now, where were you sent to?
I was sent to a brigade called 70 Infantry Brigade, deployed which, as a result of the Chinese concentrating, was deployed against the Chinese in the northern region called Ladakh.
Now, what was the composition of your brigade, the 70th Infantry Brigade?
My composition was three infantry battalions, a force called the Ladakh Scouts, which we had raised locally, which corresponded to what you would call the British had raised in the Northeast earlier, called the SM Rifles. So we had raised the Ladakh Scouts from the local people because they knew the terrain better. And I had an artillery regiment, plus the usual engineer support in a field company. So we were deployed along the Indus axis, the river Indus axis, from Tibet back into Kashmir. So my headquarters was at 14,500 feet. Most of my defenses were at 11,500 feet, but some of my defenses were at 23,000 feet.
Did this, I mean, that's excessive. Oh, it seems to people in this country that would seem very high indeed up to be. Did it have an impact on?
Yes, it did, in the sense that people suffered from what is called pulmonary edema. You have difficulty in breathing, and as a result, your lungs get clogged with water and you can die overnight. So it was a question of acclimatization. Initially, when the Indian Army went in 62, this process of acclimatization had not been understood because, shall we say, people were flown in. In the old days, all the explorers and missionaries went in on horseback or muleback. So as a result, they acclimatized progressively, moving around slow motion. But when you went in by air, as happened in 62, it was quickly realized that these so-called acclimatization procedures were not there. Anyway, the Americans didn't come to aid us with any weapons as such. They did provide aid in the form of air support, logistic support with C-130 aircraft for a period of time. And so also they agreed to, shall we say, six mountain divisions being equipped with lighter weapons than what we had inherited from the British. So instead of your normal infantry division, which operated only in the plains, you had so-called American divisions, not American division, Indian divisions equipped with American arms for high altitude warfare. The Americans physically did not come in except in the form of these air maintenance aircraft, C-130s.
But they supplied the equipment for mountain divisions.
They supplied the equipment for mountain divisions. But that, of course, took time, because by the time that was digested, the Chinese had withdrawn. Or by the time that arrived, the Chinese had withdrawn. But those divisions were the ones that the Chinese wanted to pin down now, and because they were in peace stations, to avoid them being used against Pakistan.
Now, what form did the tension on the Chinese border take? I mean, what were the Chinese actually doing? Did they cross the Indian border, or what did they do?
Well, when I arrived, they were massed in their thousands on the border in Tibet, and they gave physical displays of their numbers. Obviously, we were outnumbered insofar as that was concerned. But my appreciation was that these demonstrations by them were entirely for propaganda purposes. They were not going to actually attack. My personal appreciation, though my superiors sometimes often is not disagreed, because I personally felt that the Chinese are essentially logical people. They're not emotional. So if they have reached up to their claim line, which they had reached in 62 in Ladakh, they were not going to, shall we say, attack across it. Though, as I say, most of my superiors did not agree on the count of the numbers that the Chinese had deployed. So I had to take account of that attitude also. So I was in the operational posture to meet the Chinese.
So they didn't cross the border, they demonstrated on the border.
The odd patrol did cross, because the area is several hundred kilometers, or several hundred miles the border is. But nevertheless, you could see from the foot impressions that the Chinese, odd Chinese patrol did cross. But it was part of their so-called demonstrations in trying to acquire information. But there was no overt attack against my troops.
Would you have opened fire on a Chinese patrol if you'd found it, your side of the border?
Yes, we were obliged to try to capture them. I mean, the idea was to snaffle them, if possible. Otherwise, to shoot them. But the point is, the whole area was so vast, covered in snow. The point is that there were gaps. It was, you could say, a porous border.
Now, what form of defensive positions had your brigade taken up?
Well, we had, in view of our experience in 62, you had to guard the dominating features. It was no purpose in dominating the low-lying areas, because the Chinese could overwhelm you. So we held these dominating heights. Wherever the heights existed, going the Indus as it entered Ladakh from Tibet, from a place called Demchok. At Demchok, we would possibly only have a Ladakh scout's outpost. But as we went along, as the Chinese went along, wherever the heights were, they would encounter the regular army.
And would they actually dig in, or was that possible in the mountains? Or what form would their position take?
We had actually dug in and made bunkers in these mountains, using explosives in some cases, because digging was not possible.
What form did the bunkers take? What pattern?
Well, the bunkers took place, the normal pattern of a bunker. You have a certain amount of depth, and you have overhead protection. So we had wooden roofs placed on these bunkers to make them secure from Chinese artillery fire. It was not possible to make concrete roofs at that altitude, for the simple reason of the climate. So you can't compare it to some of the bunkers that were there on the Northwest frontier, comparable to the Siegfried Line or the Maginot Line. But they were bunkers in the Japanese pattern, digging down and covered with wood to protect you from artillery fire.
Did you have any sort of defensive capability or plan if anything had turned nuclear? Because Chinese were a nuclear power.
No, but not at that point of time.
No, okay. I'm not very familiar with this period.
No, so not at that point of time. You see, the Chinese nuclear explosions at Lop Nor were afterwards.
So there was no nuclear element to it?
There was no nuclear element to it, but they were testing their missiles. They were testing their missiles. They had no nuclear warhead at that point of time, because that the Chinese-American scientists who defected with his American wife from the USA to China, I mean, he had defected already. So they were working on it, but they first had to establish the missiles. So the missiles, I could see they're being tested. And when I reported them, my superiors thought that I was having delusions. It's a true story, but the point is I did report these missiles being tested in 1968. I could see them flying in front of me. But they were landing in the Chinese-held area of Tibet. They were not landing in my area, but I could see that part. But as I say, nobody believed me. It's only later, when the Chinese held their first nuclear explosion in Lop Nor, that they actually woke up to the fact that these missiles were being tested in order to carry nuclear warheads.
Now, what about the Indian response? I mean, a brigade doesn't sound much to move up. Was it? Were there many?
No, I was one brigade.
That's what I mean. What was the whole build-up?
The whole build-up was of a division that had been built up progressively from 62 after the Chinese attack.
Which division was it? Do you know the number?
It was a newly raised division, 3 Infantry Division.
3rd Infantry.
It was a newly raised division. Initially, at the time of the Chinese attack, there was only one brigade. But obviously, it was then realized that it was minuscule or infinitesimal compared to what the Chinese had. So, as I say, when I was AQMG Logistics in Headquarters Western Command, we had gradually inducted a complete division. So you had a division of 3 brigades, two forward and one in reserve in depth.
Now, how did you get on? Who was your divisional general, and how did you get on with him as a relationship? What did you think of him?
I had two divisional generals. My first one was a Major General George Bharat Singh. He was not a Christian.
George
Bharat Singh. George Bharat, B-H-A-R-A-T, S-I-N-G-H. George Bharat Singh.
And what was he like as a superior officer?
I had no difficulties with him because I had known him before. He was my chief instructor at Wellington when I was instructor of this thing. And so George Bharat Singh, his name has a history of its own, in the sense that his father had studied law here in Britain, married an English woman, and so therefore, to loyalty to the British, had named his son George. And Bharat, of course, showed that he was Indian. Bharat is the actual name of India, because India, that is Bharat, is in the Indian constitution. The actual Hindi or Hindu name of India is Bharat, but India has been kept for purposes of international understanding as a name.
And the other?
The other one was a Major General Gurbakhsh Singh Gill.
How do you spell that? Sorry.
G-U-R-B-A-X, then Singh, S-I-N-G-H.
Gurbakhsh
Singh Gill, G-I-L-L. Gill is his so-called village name, but in Punjab. I knew him before because he and I had been instructors together at Staff College. So he'd come on promotion to Ladakh as a Major General, and I'd come on promotion as a Brigadier.
Now, what did you think of these two officers as commanding officers? I mean, tactically
I thought Major General Gurbakhsh Singh Gill was very good.
In what way?
He was, first of all, he had a good eye for ground. He was from the ranks. He was from the ranks in British days. He'd been commissioned in British days, pre-war. So, George Bharat Singh was from civilian life pre-war. Both I'm Indian Military Academy graduates. But possibly Gurbakhsh Singh Gill, from the point of view nitty-gritty, was more down-to-earth. I mean, I'm not saying that due to his service in the ranks, but whatever it was, he had a better eye for detail than George Bharat Singh had.
Were they both hard-working? I mean, you believed in hard work, I know, from what you've told me before. Were they hard-working?
Gurbakhsh Singh Gill was as hard-working as myself. I mean, George Bharat Singh, shall we say, was more la-di-da, you could say. But that is the milieu that you've been brought up in, basically.
Did the fact that you'd known them before, I mean, you know, was this part of the function of the Staff College, that you'd meet people who'd be, you know, it was a chance for officers to get to know each other?
Well, that is so. I mean, the point is, one of the aims of setting up a Defence Services Staff College was that you would meet people of all three services. So, shall we say, in terms of the airlift to Ladakh, I would know some of the pilots, I would know some of the I would know the Air Officer Commanding. From that point of view, cooperation with the Air Force was easier. I was officiating as General Officer Commanding of Ladakh when one of the supply aircraft, the Russian AN-12, crashed and disappeared into a glacier. It has now just been found, according to the papers. So that is, it crashed in 68. It crashed in 68, and now the moraine of the glacier is just throwing up bits and pieces. Shall we say, 35 years later.
Now, anything else about your time in command of 70th Infantry Brigade that you think might help us to understand that period?
No, I would only say that my appreciation to the Chinese would not cross their claim line proved correct, but that has not necessarily been accepted by my superiors as the pattern of Chinese intentions, because as long as they're in collusion with Pakistan, and the feeling is that the Chinese could cross their claim line. But I, on the ground, made a dispassionate assessment that the Chinese would not cross their claim line, and I was proved correct in 1965.
So the next posting would be in September 68, when you went to Headquarters Western Command at Simla, onto the Brigade Operations, Brigade General Staff, as the Operations Staff Officer, as GSO-1 is what?
No, GSO-1 is a Lieutenant Colonel. I went as Brigadier General Staff.
Right.
So I went as Brigadier General Staff to Headquarters Western Command. I was asked for by the General Officer Commanding in Chief, because he felt that my predecessor had really not got down to any details. So, within 6 months of my predecessor taking over, he'd been posted out, and I, from Ladakh, was brought in.
Now, can you tell us exactly what your job was? Can you describe to us what you were doing?
I was the brigadier in charge of the general staff operations, both with Pakistan and with China, as also writing training instructions, operation instructions, and operation orders. So in my time, I updated a training instruction one issues every year, training notes one issues from time to time, and I updated the operation instructions and the operation orders.
Well, tell us a bit more about that. In what way were you updating them? What were the new lessons you were incorporating?
Well, they were not lessons as such. There was a new approach. inasmuch as the 65 operations with Pakistan were now over after the Tashkent Agreement, the ceasefire had taken place. But now it was up to us to digest our lessons, that we would not be, shall we say, taken by surprise. In the event, of course, I must make it clear that whatever the West may think, it was Pakistan who was always attacked. For some reason, the West considers Pakistan as a kind of eastern rampart against communism. And as is now clear in the latest books, that the Americans have virtually turned a blind eye to the Pakistani collusion for their nuclear bomb and their collaboration with China.
Now, what were these? We'll turn back to that, because I think that's going to be a bigger theme as we can move on. What about these lessons? What were the lessons of the war with Pakistan in 1965?
Well, the lessons were that
this is 3 years, 4 years later, 3 years later, 68.
Well, 3 years later, we had to digest them because we had not withdrawn in 65. We were still on the border. But we now realized that we could not, in all circumstances, have troops so far back, because the Chinese again, though they had given an assurance to the Americans that they would not, the Americans had funded them for six divisions, both money-wise as well as equipment-wise. So though the Eisenhower had given in writing to India that the Americans would see to it that Pakistan would not use the American aid for offensive purposes, in the event the Americans did nothing. So India had to come to the conclusion that we had to look after ourselves and not heed whatever the American assurances may be. Because whereas they had not funded us from the point of view in 62 of providing some light weapons, all the light weapons that they had provided us were defensive. Whereas they had provided Americans had provided Pakistanis with all their offensive weapons.